Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Colette Feehan is an audiobook director with a PhD in linguistics who specializes in multi-language books, books with technical jargon, and multi-book series that require maintaining a strong pronunciation database. Colette's doctoral research focused on the intersection of articulatory and acoustic phonetics and vocal performance specific to character voiceover, using ultrasound to look at how actors move the parts of their vocal tract around to make different voices. Topics discussed include acoustic phonetics, voiceover, audiobooks, voice acting, perturbation theory, pronunciation guides, accents, and contract work. Links to Colette's LinkedIn and social media accounts and other resources mentioned are in the show notes. I would like to welcome our guest today, Colette Feehan, who we connected through Linkcom, right? Isn't that where this connection came from?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So listeners to the podcast will know that we do the Fringe Festival part of it, the Ling Fest. And we have also started going to Linkcom proper, and this connection came through Emily Pace, who's one of the other folks who does the Linguistics Career Launch. So, Colette, I am so happy to have you join. I haven't talked to any linguists who do what you do, so I am really eager to dive into your journey and what you do for a living. And as always, what I like to start with people is talking about how you found out what linguistics was.
Oh, that's a great question. So I feel like from birth, I somehow knew what linguistics was.
Okay.
I have so many little memories from growing up where it was just very clear that I was supposed to get into phonetics. My favorite one is I was probably between 5 and 7, and my best friend and I, we wanted to stay up all night at our sleepover. And my mom kept hearing us whispering to each other and coming in and being like, go to sleep, girls. And we kept getting frustrated, well, how could she hear us? We're whispering. And suddenly it dawned on me. I was like, oh my God, the S's are really loud.
You were too sibilant.
And I was like, we got to whisper with a lisp. Just whisper with a lisp. And my mom did not hear us a single time after we started whispering with a lisp.
That is amazing. That is so cool. I mean, what a practical application of your linguistic knowledge there. That's fantastic. I love it.
And then a more serious answer to your question is, I think sometime in, I started learning Spanish. I went to a series of summer camps called Concordia Language Villages. That are language immersion summer camps. So I started learning Spanish at a really young age. So the word linguist got tossed around a lot because I picked up Spanish very quickly. I was kind of tangentially related to that for a while, or tangentially aware that it exists. But I still didn't really know what it meant. And then I got to college and I tried to declare a major in linguistics before having taken a single class in linguistics. And they were like, you can't do that. So then I was like, all right, I'll be back here in 6 months. And took my first linguistics class and indeed majored in that in psychology. But I don't think I actually fully understood what linguistics was until I actually took that class. It was not clear.
It's funny when you were talking about the word linguist getting thrown around. I often see people using the word linguist simply to mean someone who speaks multiple languages.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, we could call them polyglots instead. That might be a little more accurate. And it's just so interesting that people's paths to linguistics come in different ways. Yours came pretty early. I've spoken to a lot of people who didn't really discover it until they actually got into graduate school. They thought they were going into grad school for something else. And then it was like, oh no, I really like linguistics. I have to switch now. But it sounds like you sort of knew. Did you know that you were going to go to grad school after you finished your undergrad?
Yes. As a child, I was convinced I would do paleontology. But definitely from a very young age, I was like, yes, I will do a PhD. So I went into like undergrad with the expectation that immediately after that I'd do grad school. Mm-hmm. I did end up taking a year off after undergrad because I did undergrad in 3 years and was pretty burnt out, but then mm-hmm. went right back to it.
Mm-hmm. And when you were looking, I'm just curious now, when you were looking at grad schools, were you looking at something specific, like a person or an area that they specialize in? You know, at that point, did you know that you really wanted to do phonetics?
I knew I wanted to do phonetics. I didn't, honestly, it's not always clear which programs are going to be the best fit for mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. And I ended up at Indiana University, but I'm originally from Indiana. So obviously I was like, I don't want to go back to Indiana. Mm-hmm. So I kind of poo-pooed it, for a long time, but then, I got accepted. I visited, I met with a bunch of professors, and it ended up being exceptionally serendipitous. During my first semester of graduate school, Dr. Stephen Lulich in the speech and hearing department finished up like piloting and troubleshooting his methodology for using 3D, 4D ultrasound to look at what the tongue is doing while you're speaking in near real time. And that ended up being exactly the methodology I needed to investigate the question I wanted to investigate for my dissertation.
What was the question?
I wanted to know how voice actors
do little kid voices.
So that's another thing. It was always a question that was bouncing around in my head for a long time. I was a theater kid, if you couldn't tell already. And I remember around like fifth or sixth grade, I liked to like creep up behind people backstage in the dark and be like,
"Don't you want to play with me?"
And of course, everyone was like, "Stop that! Never do it again." But then they would always be like, "How are you doing that?" Mm-hmm. And at some point, I realized I was like, "Well, how? Like, what am I doing? I don't know." And also, we're all the theater kids, so why am I the only one who can do it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had that question in my brain for decades. And when I got to undergrad, I was like, well, surely the linguists will know. So I went to a professor's office hours and I was like, what am I doing
when I talk like this?
And they were like, first of all, never do that again. second of all, I have no idea. You tell me, what are you doing? So then I did what any reasonable person would do, and I just started cold calling voice actors at their Comic-Con tables.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And asking them, when you're doing a little kid sounding voice, what are you doing? And I would get answers in two different camps. They would either be like me and they'd be like, I don't know, I just do it. Or they would say things that like intuitively make sense, but like mm-hmm. are not articulatorily descriptive. Like, mm-hmm. oh, well, I put my voice up here and they'd like mm-hmm. point at their forehead or something. Yeah. And you're like, well, I mean, like, I get what you're, I'm picking up what you're putting down, but like you, that's not what you're doing though. Like yeah. your voice does not resonate in your mm-hmm. prefrontal cortex. So at that point, I was like, I actually think this is an interesting question that we might not have an answer to. So yeah. I would like to try to answer it.
Oh, that's so cool. What you were just saying, the way people describe it reminds me of when I was singing in choirs, how choir directors would try to give you instruction. And it was never, you know, like contract this muscle. It's always like, put your voice up here. And all
make
of that.
Make your mouth yeah, a cathedral.
Exactly. All of that singing advice is just so, like like you said, it's intuitive. You understand it metaphorically, but physically it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And it really yeah. doesn't help you. Like, you know, breathe through your head. Like, well, I yeah, can't exactly. actually. That doesn't
or
work
like,
for me.
Make the sound come out the tippy top of your head.
The tippy top of your head, exactly. There's a string up there and you're just pulling the sound out.
Mm-hmm.
So cool. So indulge me for a minute. How do you make that voice? What do you do? What are you doing?
So I kind of lucked out actually with my dissertation research in that, every piece of the puzzle that I pulled apart kind of corroborated the other pieces of the data. So basically what I did was I used 3D, 4D ultrasound, which means three physical dimensions and then your fourth dimension is time. And what I did was I wanted to see, I looked at voice actors speaking in their regular adult voice and in a
simulated child voice.
And I was able to get a few pretty amazing voice actors to come into the lab, and they signed non-anonymity clauses, so I can give them credit for their participation in the research. I had Veronica Taylor, who was the original Ash Ketchum in Pokemon.
Amazing.
In the English dub. I got Todd Haberkorn, who is in basically every anime, just pick one. and Laurel DeWan-Saldúa, who was in Gatchaman and Food Wars, and Christopher Kreider Plonka, who was a student at the time. And then I also piloted on myself and one other person who wanted to remain anonymous. So I had six people. Yeah. So I collected data from six people. After I piloted on myself, I saw a couple things. I collected just data with the ultrasound. And I, while looking at tongue positions, I noticed that when speaking in the simulated child voice, my tongue was basically squished farther forward in my mouth. It was my, I was gesture fronting. And I was like, okay, well, that kind of makes sense. Maybe I'm squishing my tongue farther forward in my mouth to simulate like a smaller oral cavity.
Yeah.
Another interesting result from this, though, was first, I think I need to explain how ultrasound works in case people don't know. So basically, the way ultrasound works is it's really high frequency sound that travels really efficiently while it's going through a medium that is relatively the same density. So while it travels through your muscles, it travels really efficiently. But then when it hits the air that's on the surface of your tongue, that's a really different density. So it scatters and it bounces back. And then the probe that you're holding under the chin times how long it took for that signal to bounce back. And then it translates it to an image that we can see. Importantly, okay, though, ultrasound cannot go through cartilage or bone. So in my images, my ultrasound images of the adult voice versus the child voice, I was seeing this big blue wedge that was way farther forward and kind of raised in the child voice condition than in the adult voice condition. And what that ended up being, it was a lack of data, but I could actually use that lack of data as data itself. It was a consequence of the ultrasound signal hitting the hyoid bone, the little bone that's in your neck.
Oh, okay.
That attaches to the root of your tongue. Yeah. So by looking at those images, I was like, okay, there's a piece of the puzzle that we're not seeing by using ultrasound by itself. So I wanted, basically, I was like, well, if I'm raising my larynx, you know, your head bone's connected to your neck bone. I was like, well, maybe I'm also raising, if I'm raising my hyoid bone, maybe I'm also raising the entire larynx. So then after I collected my pilot data, I went back and added something called electroglottography, which is basically just two pairs of electrodes. You put two above the larynx and two below the larynx. And they are able to tell you if you are raising your larynx or lowering it while you're talking. Because basically the upper channel, the upper pair, will get louder than the bottom pair if you raise your larynx. Importantly, though, it does not tell you like the degree to which you raised your larynx. Like it doesn't have a discrete measurement. But it was, at least I was able to in my data show that all of the voice actors were raising their larynx, which then in turn probably also affected how much the hyoid bone was raising and then how much farther forward my tongue was being squished in the mouth, which was really, really interesting. And then I also did some acoustic analyses showing that if you estimated vocal tract length just using the acoustics, it did show that the voice actors were shortening their laryngeals or shortening their vocal tracts by raising their laryngeals. And this is all really, really cool stuff because it totally corroborates perturbation theory, which again, sorry, physics alert. I promise it won't be that scary. But basically perturbation theory says that if, when you're trying to perceive a vowel sound, for example, we make this assumption that our vocal tract functions like a uniform tube that is closed at one end, your glottis, and open at the other, your lips. And when we perceive a sound, that depends, one, on the length of the tube, and two, where you constrict within the tube relative to the length of that tube.
Mm-hmm.
So necessarily, if you shorten your vocal tract by doing something like raising your larynx, you necessarily will have to change where you're constricting along mm-hmm. the length of the tube in order for like an ah sound to still sound like an ah sound.
Mm-hmm. Keep going.
And that's exactly what the voice actors showed us. The voice actors. And this is one of the like my biggest, claims that I think we could really bash down some doors of inquiry by working with voice actors more within linguistic research. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, if you think about it, they're basically professional vocal tract manipulators, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, exactly. If you're just, like, the whole reason it's not helpful to, like, for speech and hearing sciences, right? It's not helpful to only collect mm-hmm. data on people who speak in a typical manner without any sort mm-hmm, of problems mm-hmm. if you're trying to create therapies for people who have, you know, some sort of neuromuscular degeneration right. or have lost muscle tone due to stroke or have lost part of their tongue due to cancer or something like that. Like, you need to study those populations, but I think voice actors could also help us test out and kind of break and recreate our models of how we predict speech by asking mm-hmm. them to just do the weirdest things yeah. that they can do with their vocal tracts.
Oh, this is amazing. You can't see me, but I'm sitting here like salivating because this is absolutely like crack for me. I love this kind of data-based research into these interesting perceptual things. And just as an aside, when I was at Berkeley, my advisor, John O'Hala, had done some studies which showed that the differences between men's and women's voices generally is not natural. So men's and women's voices in the pitch really overlap most of the time, except for, you know, some people are very much taller than other people and vocal tracts are different. But in the main, they're not that different. And the reason that women's voices are, I'm putting this in quotes, higher is because it's a learned behavior. Just like you were talking about, it's a thing that you learn how to do, how to raise your larynx to make the pitch a little bit higher. And if you didn't live in a society that wanted women to have higher pitched voices, you wouldn't find it quite so often.
Yeah, makes sense.
So it totally fits in with what you were saying. So it's all like in my mind. Okay, this is amazing. What a great dissertation. That's fantastic. You finished your dissertation and were you thinking, okay, now I have to go be a voice actor? Like, what did it sort of open to you more pathways, or were you still thinking you might stay in academia?
So by the end of grad school, I was pretty much 100% sure that I didn't want to stay in academia anymore. Mm-hmm. I think the scheduling of it, where you're like just constantly behind and stressed mm-hmm. and every semester there's this like you reach a literal breaking point. I was like, I actually don't think that's for me. Mm-hmm. among a lot of other reasons. But so yeah, by the end of grad school, I was very sure I did not want to continue in academia, but I had genuinely no idea what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. That wasn't academia. Like, that was always mm-hmm. the plan, right? Like, I even said when I was like a toddler, basically, I said I wanted to get a PhD in paleontology. Like, that was mm-hmm. literally always the plan. So how I got my job is actually kind of weird and funny and bizarre. So 2020, December of 2020, I was, like everyone else, very unhappy. And, but I lucked out in that I had hit ABD right before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I, was procrastinating writing my dissertation, and just kind of on a whim decided to throw a video up onto TikTok. And like, if you go back and watch that video, you can see like how dead I am inside. Like it is not mm-hmm. a good, representation. But I just like threw up a video. I was like, here's what I study. Have you also wondered what voice actors do? If you would like to hear what I've found, go ahead and follow me. I woke up the next morning to like more than 20,000 people having followed me.
Oh my God. It was okay.
Overwhelming and confusing and exciting. And also very motivating. So I started making a little series about like, this is what my dissertation research shows. But I quickly ran out of material because I had not finished analyzing my data. So I ended up being a really, really good motivator. And I ended up like speed writing my entire dissertation in just the month of March. I ended up writing the entire thing.
Holy God. Okay. All right. That sounds like a bad idea, but I'm glad you did it and that you didn't die in the process. So yeah.
I was like, the public needs answers.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so I wrote the whole thing. I was running rounds of edits at that point, and May comes along. My defense date was set for August, but since it was set for August, I was able to walk during the May ceremony. So at my graduation ceremony, as I'm leaving, I haven't even hit the pavement. I'm on the sidewalk of the stadium. I get an email. And I usually don't open emails unless I'm on my computer. So I don't even know why I opened this email, but, I open it on my phone, and I just kind of stop. And it's a producer from, Hachette Audio, which is a publisher of audiobooks. And they were like, hey, I've seen your videos on TikTok. Like, I really love how you're able to explain, like, how to use your mouth to get different sounds. Like, have you ever considered directing audiobooks? And I was like, well, obviously, this is a scam.
Okay.
So I went home and, like, super creeped, like, found the person on their website. And I was like, all right, you seem like a real person. So I had luckily like gotten all of these like professional contacts through TikTok with like audiobook narrators. So I ended up messaging one of them, Natalie Nautis, who's an absolute delight. She just had a book come out, Gay the Prey Away. That's what it is.
Yeah. Okay, good.
And it's an exceptional book. I ended up asking her, I was like, hey, like, I don't know anything about audiobooks. Like, I just got this like kind of job offer, but I don't even know what questions to ask because I have I know nothing about audiobooks. So she was very, very kind and indulged me and let me ask her a bunch of questions. And then I wrote out basically a novel of questions for this producer, and she was like, "Wow, that sure is a lot of questions. Do you just want to talk on the phone?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's also fine, sure."
Yeah, it's like, hey, you're dealing with an academic here. I just finished my dissertation. Did you really think I was going to keep it to three questions? No.
So then we talked on the phone. I shadowed someone directing an audiobook, and I was like, okay, well, here's the other problem. Like, I defend in August, so I'm, like, kind of really busy with that. Like, is it okay if I don't start until September? And she's like, yeah, it's contract work. It's there will be books in September. And I was like, okay, all right. I will do that. I immediately had a job, which is something I'm very grateful for. I was very fortunate. A job that I didn't even know existed and turned out being just like the perfect fit for me.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. And I have to say, not completely out of the realm of reality. So many people that I've talked to have gotten their jobs one of two ways. It's either through a lot of work, sending out a lot of resumes and doing the networking. And then other times it's like you, where something just dropped into their lap. And in both cases, you have to kind of be prepared for the unexpected, right? Because you just don't know what's going to happen, and be open to the possibilities of what could be out there, because you don't know where it's going to come from. So, you know, you did your due diligence. That's great. And it wasn't a scam. Also great, because you never know too, like what kind of rando is going to be contacting you because of a thing that you did online somewhere.
Right.
So you got this job and you managed to, so you defended your dissertation. Were you still working? Like, were you doing work, or were you really focused on just getting through the program and finishing?
That summer, I actually was working up at the summer camps that I mentioned earlier, Concordia Language Villages. Mm-hmm. That summer, I worked at the Chinese one. And then the next year, I actually became the dean of the Spanish one, which I loved doing, but it is so much work. So I did resign last summer. Mm-hmm. I originally was just going to remote in because it was still like kind of hybrid COVID times because it was 2021. Mm-hmm. I was going to remote into the Chinese camp. But then I got the like a seal of approval from my advisor, like 2 days after it started. So then I just drove up to Minnesota and was part of the COVID pod.
And when did you start your producing job? Like, how did that go?
That started in September, right after I defended. They had a lot of faith in me. They just kind of let me go straight into it. It was a little... Like, I was just very tentative the first book, but it was also a good book to do first. My first audiobook that I directed was Workhorse by, I think her name was Kim Reed. And it was about her life working in the restaurant industry. So it was someone who was not a professional narrator. So she also was coming brand new to the concept of audiobooks. And I had an engineer with me who was very, very knowledgeable and very experienced. So he was able to jump in anywhere where I didn't know what I was doing.
I am sure everybody who's listening has listened to an audiobook or something similar at some point. Can you break it down a little bit? Like, what I know what a producer normally does. What do you do when you're producing an audiobook, and what kind of guidance are you giving to the narrator?
Yeah, so I'm actually a director, which is slightly different from a producer. Director. Producers are more just like coordinating everyone, going through the auditions, basically keeping track of all of the independent contractors, because the entire industry is basically just independent contractors. So like I count as an independent contractor directing the studios that we contract out for wherever the narrator or author is. That's an independent contractor. A lot of times the editor is another independent contractor. So they're keeping track of a lot of stuff. My job sounds much easier to me, at least, than what the producers do. And so what I do is basically I will get the book ahead of time. And first I'll read through the whole thing, and I will create a pronunciation guide. So that looks different depending on the genre of the book. So if it's nonfiction, honestly, it's a lot of me like looking up podcast episodes of these people who have been name dropped and hoping they say their name at the beginning of the podcast.
That sounds really familiar.
And then for sci-fi or fiction, a lot of times it's coordinating with the author team and making sure that all of their made-up people and place names are pronounced correctly, or all of their conlangs are being pronounced correctly. And then I also get brought on to a lot of like multilingual books, so books where like the characters are traveling or something. With that, I also do pronunciation for like foreign pronunciation, and how do you for some of the books, obviously it's a little more articulatory phonetics, like how am I going to explain to this person who does not speak Chinese how to pronounce these Chinese names or something. So that's the pronunciation. Another piece of my prep work is adjusting any language in the book that needs to be adjusted for audio. So that's more common with like non-fiction. So anywhere where it's like see below or like on the next page, like that doesn't make sense in audiobook format. So we need to adjust that language. Anywhere where there's like a image or a graph, those are usually included in a supplemental PDF. So I mark anywhere where we're like, this needs to be cut out for a supplemental PDF, and then adjust the language. So we have like for a graphical representation of XYZ, see the supplemental PDF.
Yeah.
And then after that's prepped, we will sometimes, depending on if I'm working with a professional narrator or an author who's never done an audiobook, we might have like a pre-production meeting so that we go over, like, for example, don't wear your favorite windbreaker to the recording session.
or jangly earrings.
Jangly earrings. Yeah. don't try to scroll on the iPad while you're talking. things like that. And then on the days that we're recording, I'll just be in their headphones. I work totally remotely.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And I will read along with them, and I will stop them anywhere where we have something, like they mispronounce something, their mouth is getting a little too clicky, it's too close to lunch, and I can hear their stomach rumbling. And then I mark the script everywhere where we do retakes and stuff so that the editors know where to find the good takes.
Okay. And you were probably going to get to this, but now I'm really curious about how long, given what you've just described and doing retakes and all that, for, you know, I don't know, an average book, how long does it take to do all this?
Yeah. I would say a good, like, range to go for is get about 15 to 25 pages done per hour.
Okay.
So usually a book that's like, you know, your regular like 250, 300 page book is going to take 3 to 4 days, 6 hour days, 1 hour for lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's doing it for 6 hours sounds like a really long time.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Sometimes if we're doing it with like a author, we might need to break early because we don't want to, you know, ruin their voice for tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Or if it's a book, like I've done one series where the narrator is just absolutely spectacular. It's a series by David Dalglish, the Level Unknown series. And John Patnode does just an absolutely stunning job and so many voices. Like that one took us kind of a long time because like you just can't. Going back to my research, they're raising and lowering their larynx so much to get these like really like more femme voices and then these really deep like knight voices, and like that's an Olympic book.
Wow.
Yeah. So it depends on several factors how long it takes, but I would say we usually schedule at minimum 2 days. Mm-hmm. Probably more often 3 days, and then up to 5 days. I've only had a few books that have gone past 5 days.
And then, so they do the recording, and then at that point, is your part done, or are you still involved in the post-production part of it?
Yeah, so when I'm directing, I might be brought in for a pickup session, so anywhere where, you know, we missed something and messed it up and the editor flagged it. But as a director, other than a pickup session, coming in and just helping them record that, that would be where my involvement ends. Also sometimes when I, on projects I didn't direct, sometimes I do quality control, which is basically the other side of the coin. So once we have basically a first draft of the book, we have two people sit down and listen to the entire thing with headphones. And just mark anywhere where you can, you know, hear something like they smacked the table that the iPad was on, or there's a mispronunciation here, or this word was pronounced differently earlier. We need to fix that or something. And then, that's pretty much all you need to do for quality control. After they fix all of the things that you flagged, you just spot check all of the areas. And then you upload the book.
How much, if any, say do you get in who's going to be the narrator for an audiobook if it's not going to be the author? There are so many people to choose from, obviously. Is that something that the book company decides, or are you allowed to get a vote in that?
I have been asked a couple times, but it's not typically something that I would be involved with. Usually that's the producer and the author's team. Sometimes mm-hmm. the author is like, I really want this person, and sometimes they get them and sometimes they don't. Most of the time it's related to budget and just availability. Yeah. There have been a few books where it just had a ton of languages and they were like, do you know any voice mm-hmm. actors who speak this language? Like, yeah. uh-huh. if they speak at least one of the languages in this book, mm-hmm. that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, other than that, I haven't typically helped with casting.
And how do you feel like you're using your linguistic skills in this job?
Oh, yeah. That's the thing that most surprised me. Like, I knew that I would be helping with, like, pronunciations. But I actually get to... I have gotten a good number of books where I've also gotten to do, like, some historical linguistics research.
Oh, cool.
So, like, maybe 2 years ago, a producer sent me a book, and they were like, can you get us pronunciations for this? And I opened it up, and it was a book about ancient Assyria. And I was like, well, yes, but... No, but yes, like nobody knows how that language sounded, but like,
right.
You are correct that I am the person who can look at the research we have and figure out our best guesses of how that language sounded.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. And if you don't, it's like, well, we always say with linguists, it's like, look, I know a guy, right? Yeah. Like there's somebody in my network that I can
absolutely.
Ask about this.
That has happened with a lot of indigenous words in books. Luckily worked with Hilaria Cruz for a little while on she was and continues to study her native language, which is Chatino, spoken in Oaxaca, Mexico, and mm-hmm. she it's a really cool language because it's tonal, which is not what you usually expect from not East Asia, and so she's totally connected with that entire like linguists who are documenting and helping revive mm-hmm. indigenous languages. So usually I'm like, do you yeah. know anybody? Do you know guy?
Yeah. This is the great thing about linguists is like, yeah, you probably know someone or you know somebody who knows someone.
Yeah. Yeah. I also have a friend from someone who was in grad school with me who is from South Korea, and she's back in South Korea, but I'm always like sending her voice memos. I'm like, how do you say these words?
So when you're working with, as a director, when you're working with the person who's doing the narration, do you give them instruction or feedback that's very linguistically based, or do you have to resort to the, you know, the singing instructor, it comes out the top of your head kind of advice? How does that work?
I'd say I've usually just gone with like articulatorily descriptive, one, book, for example, it was like, it must've been March of 22. And the original, person who was going to narrate had to drop out for some reason. So it was like a last minute rush job. The original narrator spoke Chinese. The new one does not. And mm-hmm. it was Kevin Rudd, who was the former Prime Minister of Australia. It was his book called The Avoidable War about U.S.-China mm-hmm. relations.
Oh, wow.
And the narrator for that book, again, did an absolutely stunning job. So professional. I learned so much from him, honestly, while recording this book. And he was like, no, we're going to say every name right, no matter how many times I have to say it. And we would sit there and I'd be like, I'd repeat the name and he'd say it in the sentence and I'd be like, not quite. And then I'd say it again for him. He'd repeat it. And, would just describe, I'd be like, okay, so like for this sound, like your tongue needs to be farther forward in your mouth. It's, uh-huh, it's a fricative uh-huh. that doesn't exist in English, but just like squish your tongue further forward.
Perfect. That sounds really cool. I'm just imagining you doing this. And I think for people who are used to doing that kind of work and getting that kind of feedback, the very specific things that you're saying, like squish your tongue forward, would be super helpful to them because it's not metaphorical or, you know, inspirational. It's more like physical, right? Here's what you should be doing with your articulation.
Yeah.
So you're doing this. And it sounds like you're doing great and you're loving it. Is this what you want to keep doing, or do you have other ideas?
Honestly, yeah. I love every part of the process. Like, it's just enjoyable. And I never would have even known it existed without the internet.
You have your own, well, you have a website, which we'll link to in the show notes. You do this direction. What else do you do?
I have dabbled a little bit in voice acting. Mostly, so my booth is just my closet, which is not very comfortable. So, like, I've mostly just done, like, little, you know, side projects that either aren't paid or are paid very little, and are more like labors of love. Just because I would be afraid to book something too big and then just like not have the equipment to be able to handle it, or to be able to like have to take so long to deliver it because I can't be in the closet that long.
Right.
So I think my husband and I are hoping to move back to Minnesota, which is where we met, and maybe buy a house. Who knows? In this economy. If the stars align and I manage to live in a space that's big enough to put an actual like booth, I wouldn't mind putting a couple more eggs into the voice acting basket, because I do really enjoy it. I enjoy like character voiceover more so than like narration or something. I'm not sure I would, I personally would get into narration, but that's something that is like, oh, that would be fun if I could do it. But like, I'm not trying to make that my career.
But it could always, the nice thing about it, you know, you were talking about working remotely, and now all voiceover work is remote pretty much, unless I guess you're working on a, you know, a Toy Story movie or something. So even all the actors who are doing voices for animation and various things, it's all done remotely in their little closets in their houses. Yep. And you don't actually have to be in New York or Los Angeles in order to do it. I mentioned to you in an email that I'd taken some voiceover classes at one point, and that was just at the, this is years ago, but it was just at the point where it was changing. So the woman I was taking classes with had been doing all of the commercials here in Northern California for Safeway. She was the voice of Safeway on the radio commercials. And so she was describing how in her day, you had to travel. So you had to go to all the booths that they had wherever it was, whether it was in San Francisco or Los Angeles. And that was actually a big part of who got jobs, whether you were able to go or not. But now it's all remote. And as long as you have a place that's, you know, moderately soundproof, the right environment, it's a thing that you could do. So I see how it's taken away opportunities for some people, but it's also made it much easier for lots of different diverse people to get this kind of work and to do it, so you don't have to be able to travel somewhere. And it's especially important, as you were talking about, for different languages or conlangs, or, you know, sensitivity to certain cultures and how you might pronounce things or where the emphasis is going to go. And that's cool. I think that's cool.
Yeah, especially because this is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about as well, is this idea of diversity in voiceover, because voiceover can be kind of a double-edged sword, right? Like, you don't have to look like the character, so like, you don't have to match the, you know, absurd Hollywood beauty standards to get a really cool role in a show, but also you don't have to look like the character, so who cares if you share the same background, cultural background, experiences, whatever, with the characters that you're trying to represent. So you have gotten a lot of, like, you know, pejorative use of accents that, you know, probably wasn't intended to be pejorative, but ends up being so. Things like that. So one thing that, another little piece of my dissertation that I wrote about was, I would also like my research to like, be helpful in forming a pedagogy for voice actors in terms of like vocal tract anatomy and articulation, but also as sort of a gateway for voice actors and casting directors to learn more about like sociolinguistics and sociophonetics and understanding like being sure to like check your own biases before you just like slap an accent onto a character. Right. Rosina Lippi Green, in her edition of English with an Accent, did a study looking at, like 100 or something, Disney movies, or animated movies. Maybe they weren't all Disney. But basically she was looking at the use of accent. And she found that like, if you are a villain in a Disney movie, you don't necessarily have a foreign accent, but if you have a foreign accent, it's much more likely that you're the villain. Which brings up a lot of questions. If the only place you've ever heard XYZ specific foreign accent is in media where it's showing you that that accent is always associated with villain or bad guy or evil, like you're forming unconscious biases whether you want to or not. And how much does that play into, you know, xenophobia and all of these things? So I would love to, I would love my research to be a little bit of a gateway into like taking into consideration, like, okay, we have this character, this is their background. I immediately, like, my knee-jerk reaction was to put a Russian accent on them. Why did I do that? Russia doesn't even exist in this universe. Like, another thing that's interesting, like, it does make sense, like, in the, like, history of animation, right? Animation tends to be a shorter form. If you're talking about TV series, like a lot of times it's like an 11-minute runtime and you don't have a lot of time for exposition and explaining who this character is. And if you just have a character come in for, you know, one punchline and part of the punchline is that you're supposed to immediately understand that this character is dumb, it makes sense that we started using the shorthand of like a Southern accent to just get across real quick. Like, this character's dumb. They said something funny. Yep. Off they go. But I would love to see more conversations and more consideration into why we do that, how we do that, how could we do it differently in the future.
And of course, it all grows out of the long tradition in Hollywood of doing similar things. Yeah, many people have brought up, you know, whenever you're watching old movies where there's a ruling class, I take the Ten Commandments as a good example. Why do they have British accents? Why do the pharaohs have British accents? You know? Like, because that's a stereotype about who should be in charge, white guys with British accents, you know, it's not very subtle. I think it's changed a lot. Now with a lot of animation, I was just thinking about some of the Star Trek animated stuff in Lower Decks in particular, which I love. They went to a lot of trouble to make sure that the people that they were hiring to do the voiceover work matched the ethnicities of the people in the show, even though it takes place in the far future. It could be anybody, right? But they really wanted it to be more realistic. And I so appreciate that. And also in some of the other animated things, and I was thinking of Star Trek Prodigy too, that they've hired people for non-human characters who are gender fluid or non-binary. Like, hey man, what a great idea. You know, like, let's get someone who doesn't sound like what you would consider a male or female human to sound like. And it's not othering, it's just making it different, making it sound somewhat different, but still employing a person who has an amazing talent and just this ability to make their voice be different from anything that you've heard before. And I love that people are willing to take those chances.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was also going to point out the Lion King is one that always makes me like giggle in the sense that like, surely no one was thinking about this when they were making their, you know, casting decisions or when they were making the voices they were going to do for the characters. But like Scar is our upper class villain, right? He's got a British accent. Why has he got a British accent? And then we have our royal advisor also with a British accent, Zazu. But then we have Simba, who, you know, just has like an American accent. And then and then you move on to your outcasts, right? Our lower class villains have all stigmatized dialects, right? They're either speaking Chicano English, Black English, or are just nonverbal entirely. And then, but then you have your other outcasts, but they're not evil, so they have a less stigmatized, non-standard variant Jersey accent.
It's there's so much bias built into all of that stuff, and it, as you were pointing out before, for most people it's invisible, right? Why did we make this choice? I don't know. It just seemed like the right thing to do, and I was following tradition, and this is what people have always done. And it's now I think people are finally taking the time to go, wait, well, maybe we don't have to do it that way. We could do it a different way. So I am hopeful that the field of this kind of acting and voice work just continues to expand as more people are able to do it. And the people who are in charge are more willing to take those chances because they see that the stuff that they've done has actually been successful and people weren't, I don't know, offended or put off or some nonsense like that.
Yeah. Especially because like at the end of the day, all that matters is did they do a good job? And if you're casting them to begin with, you know, they're going to do a good job, right? Like,
yeah.
And if they're, life experiences and their, you know, background and their heritage and things can help bring more body and more depth to these characters. Why would you not want to benefit from that?
Yeah. I was also thinking of in the Marvel movies, right? They got Taika Waititi to do the voice of Korg. And the voice that he uses for that isn't his voice. It's a very specific New Zealand stereotype that is perfect for the character. And if you're not from New Zealand, you're probably not going to get that joke. But it's very, very, I have had this explained to me, but it's very, very specific. And he did that on purpose. And it's great that they gave him the freedom to do that, to pick a voice that's not, it's not a comedy voice, right? But it is very distinctive when you hear it. And you can kind of, like, if you know his voice, you know that it's him, but you can see that he's doing a character there. And again, that they let him do that in that small part is just super cool. And then when you see that character in other properties, like, you recognize it because it's like, oh yeah, he's that guy. I know his voice. And I love that. I think that's really good. So here's a big question right at the end. Do you want to see more linguists in your line of work? Do you think it's a good place for linguists to be working if this is the kind of thing they're interested in?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think a few things that might make it not for people who are just like, oh, well, I like voiceover and stuff. Like, right. Like it's, you're running a business, you're an independent contractor, right? Like that comes with all of the complications and difficulties of being essentially freelance, right? Like there's no health insurance. You only have jobs when you have contracts. Like you need to be on top of like, you know, contacting your, like all of your contacts and being like, my schedule for next month is totally open. Like I need jobs. Like you have to be very proactive about that. And then, I mean, it is, you know, a subset of the showbiz industry, right? Like you're going to be working with individuals who don't necessarily want to do things for the sake of the art. They are doing it for the sake of the money and they want it done fast and they want it done, you know, they don't necessarily want to be taking direction on how to make that sentence sound the most, whatever emotion it's supposed to sound like. So, like, those are all things that, like, you're just going to need to be okay with if you want to go into a job like this. But then the other great things about it are it's freelance. So if I want to go on vacation, I can just not take a contract for the week that I want to go on vacation. Like, I answer to no one but myself. Can also turn down anything that I don't want, right? Like horror books really scare me, so I do not take horror books. They freak me out.
Yeah.
Like anything like that. And then like I set my schedule more or less. Sometimes maybe this one's kind of goes in both camps. There are some books that I've directed on not New Zealand time, on Iceland time, on France time. So sometimes I'm working at like 4 a.m. Instead of, and sometimes I'm working at like 1 p.m., 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. or something, mm-hmm. depending on wherever mm-hmm. the studio that we're recording at remotely is.
Yeah, that's great that you brought all of that up, because on the podcast, we've talked with people about work environments and what works. So for some people, what you've just described is a type of work environment where you can really thrive. Like, it's fine because it's interesting and it's fun and you get to meet people. And also it's sort of project based, so you don't have time to get bored with whatever mm-hmm. you're doing. So but you also have to have a personality type where you can roll with those punches and be able to jump on a dime. And some people just are not suited for that. And yeah. it would be much better for them to have a more regular job. So yeah, my job doing project work for naming is similar in that way, where you're kind of always working if you want to be working mm-hmm. and things change really quickly. But it for me, I love it because I am never bored. There's always something new coming up. And by the time I am getting bored with a project, it's over. And then there's a new one and I get to find out all kinds of new things. And plus you're constantly learning because, mm-hmm. you know, in your case, like you're reading new books and you're meeting authors and you're finding out about all these topics. And I bet, you know, for anything that you are the director on, now you're an expert, right? Like for the 3 weeks that you're working on it, you are the expert in that. And then you go on to something else and you can become an expert in something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of the job that I love the most, is that I'm just constantly learning things and I'm constantly being yeah. like exposed to like books that I would either just like would never have entered my realm of like existence. Like I just would never have known that it existed at all, or books that I would never pick up by myself. Like I did a book on like businesses last fall, and I was like, I would never mm-hmm. read a business nonfiction book in my free time, but it was actually really interesting and I learned a whole bunch.
Yeah. I like the way you said that. That was great.
like that is not what I'm trying to do on a Tuesday yeah. night, winding down. Yeah. I'm going to read about business.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Cool. Well, I think that's all the questions I have for you. This has been so interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time. Is it okay if I put your LinkedIn profile link and a link to your website in the show notes in case people want to contact you just with questions or maybe do an informational interview?
For sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. We'd like to keep that linguist network going.
Yes. So, it is robust and very welcoming, honestly. I feel like the linguistics yeah. network is much more welcoming than other fields.
Yeah, totally agree. 100%. And that's why you're here, because we got you through the network. So we are continuing to do it. Colette, thanks so much for spending the time with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I was delighted when you guys asked me to come on.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held 2 online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.